If you heard that CD playing a little bit earlier when you came in, that was Joyce, my dad, about 6 months before he died. Shortly after that interview with a Canadian broadcaster, Nathan Cohen, who came from CBC to interview Dad, his voice began to fail completely. That was the last stage, about 6 months before he died, when he could really talk properly. And there are signs in the voice that it's already beginning to go. Arthur Joyce Lunel Carey died exactly 50 years ago, on March the 29th, 1957, at home in Oxford, where he had lived since 1920. Oxford was still, at that date, a smallish country town of about 60,000 people. It was years before the Morris Motor and Press Steel Works in Cowley would turn Greater Oxford into an industrial city with an ancient university in its midst. The Careys chose Oxford for several reasons. A strong attraction was convenient proximity to London, which is only 60 miles from Oxford. The best trains get to town in an hour. So it is perfectly possible to take an afternoon train to London, have dinner, see a show, and be back in Oxford before midnight. Another attraction was that in a university town, you were likely to meet interesting, well-read people, and there will probably be lots of music. Alas, both of them, both of them were familiar with the town from before the war. In the 20s, there was a sort of church hall type of playhouse, which ran a fortnightly repertory. But in the 30s, the large new theatre was put up, suitable for major touring companies and opera. And built a bit later there is also a fine playhouse, regarded by some actors as a stepping stone to the West End. Oxford also has an excellent preparatory school for boys. State elementary schools in the 20s were still pretty basic. The Careys already had 2 boys to educate, and 2 more were to follow. Joyce felt strongly Irish, and also made clear to us that we belonged to a very old family going back to the 12th century. The main Carey family is centred in South Devon, and the Torbay telephone book is still full of Careys. It wouldn't be surprising if one of them had checked in at Fawlty Towers. So how come Ireland? Well, in the late 16th century, Queen Elizabeth I's advisers informed her that Lough Foyle in northwest Ireland was potentially important strategically, both for England and for an enemy, probably Spain. That part of Ireland, a peninsula with Lough Foyle on the east side and Lough Swilly on the west, is the top part of Donegal and named Inishowen. In earlier times, the whole area was called Tyrconnell. I've got 2 maps here, which we'll pass round. Could you get it started, Jane? This is an old map, I'm not sure of the date, of Tyrconnell, where Inishowen is spelt as 2 words. Here's a modern touring map of the area. And you'll see that Lough Foyle's narrow entrance to the sea means that from outside there are very few directions in which you can see into it. Like Scarpa Flow in the Orkneys, you could hide a fleet in there. At the head of Lough... At the head of Lough Foyle was a village called Londonderry, and in 1599, Elizabeth appointed Sir George Carey of Cockington, which is a small village in Devonshire, as treasurer at war in Ireland, charged with suppressing rebellious tribal chieftains and transforming Londonderry into a full-sized walled city. The wall is still there and in excellent condition, but most of modern Londonderry is outside it. I'm told it was an early case of prefabrication. Pre-cut timbers were shipped to Londonderry with instructions how to turn them into houses. In tribal fighting, Cahir O'Doherty, chieftain of Inishowen, who was making a nuisance of himself, was defeated and captured. By an interesting irony, it was the Doherty family who finally bought the Carey house in Ireland and still live there. Another notable Elizabethan Carey was Sir Robert Carey, who wrote a fascinating memoir. I have an edition of 1759, which is about 150 years after the action described. He was present at the death of Queen Elizabeth, though at the very end the men withdrew and the court ladies stayed with her. One came out a little later to say the Queen had gone. Sir Robert knew that there was a plot a foot in the council, and that they would try to prevent him doing his duty, which was to write to Edinburgh and tell King James that Elizabeth was dead and he was now King of England as well as King of Scotland. He evaded the plotters and rode north that night at high speed, making it from London to Doncaster in one night, a distance of 155 miles, and an amazing ride. On the next day, on the appalling roads of the time, his horse stumbled and they both fell, and by bad luck the horse, thrashing about on the ground, happened to kick poor Robert in the head. But in spite of heavy bleeding, he went on, though he wrote, "It made me so weak that I was forced to ride a soft pace after." He got to Edinburgh and told King James, who was at first unwilling to believe him because he hadn't brought the official papers from the council. Obviously, he couldn't because he'd avoided contact with them. But he produced, in his own words, a blue ring from a fair lady. Sometime before, James had sent a sapphire ring to one of Elizabeth's court ladies, instructing that when the Queen died, it was to be returned to him, by which he would know that the Queen was dead. Seeing it in Sir Robert's hands, he was convinced. He got the best surgeons to dress Robert's head, gave him plenty to eat in comfortable lodgings so that he could rest before heading south again. I'll pass that round too. Be careful of it. I've had the back replaced because it was falling apart. That comes from my dad's library. It's one of his books he collected. As I say, that's the second edition of 1759. The Irish branch of the family became known as the Careys of Innishowen, and they stayed in Ireland for the next 300 years, until the end of the 19th century. Naturally, over the years, the basically English Careys acquired a good admixture of Irish blood through casual liaison and through marriage. An example is Joyce's mother, who was Charlotte Louisa Joyce before she married, an Irish family. I suppose James Joyce could have been a distant cousin. Charlotte's maiden name was adopted as one of the new baby's Christian names. By 1888, when Joyce was born in Londonderry, the Careys of Innishowen were falling on hard times. After the terrible famines, Ireland was in a bad way. Most of the Careys' tenants were destitute and could not pay the rent. So my forebears let the arrears pile up and extended the mortgages to keep things going. As soon as the banks realised that the arrears never would be paid, the Arrears Act of 1892 wiped out most rent arrears as the only way to get the country on its feet and make a fresh start. As soon as the banks realised that the arrears never would be paid, they lost no time on foreclosing the mortgages. The Careys were ruined and the family property was now owned by the bank. There was one house, this was all happening when Joyce was a small child, and though the final 19th century Carey house, built a little inland from Loch Foyle and called Castle Carey, was still occupied, presumably by paying rent to the bank. It stood empty for years and was finally demolished in the 1950s. White Castle, the Carey residence built in the 18th century, still stands on the shore of Loch Foyle and has been kept in very good condition by the Doherty owners. When my eldest son John and I visited in 1997, they had just spent £12,000 on a new roof, and some scenes painted on the interior doors by long-dead Carey ladies are carefully preserved. This use of the word castle very rarely means a fortified building. It's more like the French chateau. It normally means an imposing country house of some sort. In its Irish usage. As the Innishowen Careys, now definitely poor relations, trickled back to England and some to America, a few did stay in Ireland, so the family was scattered all over the place. Joyce's childhood was spent partly in London and partly in Ireland at Castle Carey. But by the time he was adult, he was living in England permanently. He never lost his sense of belonging in Innishowen, though. Two of his novels, Castle Corner and A House of Children, are partly autobiographical, Castle Corner also including some of his African adventures. After school at Clifton College in Bristol, Joyce thought he would attempt a career as an artist. He went to Paris, where he was very poor, but eagerly absorbed the exciting atmosphere of the time. He fell in love with the Impressionists. But he didn't take formal lessons in Paris. In fact, his French was never a strong point. He studied technique in Edinburgh, but decided after a time that although quite competent, he would never reach the kind of high standard he was aiming at, and left. Frankly, he was a bit of a drifter at this time, not sure what he wanted to do. Some of the Inishowen Careys never got themselves a proper job in England and went well downhill. The main family was no help. They felt like disowning these wild and probably dangerous Irish relations. At least my grandfather had the good sense to study engineering and was successful enough to pay for Joyce and his younger brother Jack to get a reasonable education. The next thing Joyce tried was Oxford. He enrolled as an undergraduate at Trinity College. He nominally studied law, but did little work and mostly had a good time. His best friend was Heneage Ogilvie, a Scot who was doing medicine. Heneage invited Joyce to visit at the Ogilvie's large house at Harrow-on-the-Hill in northwest London, at that time still almost country. The obviously prosperous Ogilvies were another very old family going back to the Scottish kings, and there were five grown-up children, two boys and three girls. Joyce soon fell for the youngest daughter, Gertie. The father, Maxwell Ogilvie, had trained as an engineer but eventually found himself in Valparaiso, Chile, working for a large import-export firm. He met and married a German girl, Mary Anna Wolf, and the five children were all born in Valparaiso. He became rich, retired back in England, and built the Harrow House. Gertie came to England at about 10, I think. The highly respectable Ogilvies took a fairly dim view of this undisciplined Anglo-Irish fellow. He was known to have lived in Paris, and goodness knows what he got up to there. He obviously had no money to speak of, and Gertie Ogilvie found him argumentative and unsettling. Also in those days, you had to dodge a chaperone if you wanted to say anything more than trivia to a girl of that class. Here is a pastel of Gertie Ogilvie in 1909 when she was 18. Yep. Well, you could put it on the table over there and that people could look at it afterwards. Joyce decided, am I being boring or is it all right? No. Joyce decided to show Gertie what he was made of. He was now seriously in love with her. In 1912, he showed daring do by going off to the First Balkan War, intending to join the Montenegrin army. But eventually he joined the Red Cross. After some pretty harrowing experiences, he came back when the war ended in 1913. Later, he wrote a book about it, beautifully illustrated with pen and ink drawings. He never published it in his lifetime, regarding it as juvenilia. But it was brought out posthumously and elegantly by University of Texas Press. It's called Memoir of the Bobotes, and it's in the display out there. After Montenegro, he did return to Oxford, but he was already 24, and this time, after his accumulated experiences in Ireland, Paris, Edinburgh, and the Balkans, he felt too old, and Oxford life bored him, though he did make friends with an Oxford philosophy don, which began a lifelong fascination with philosophy. He applied to the Colonial Office for the post of Assistant Commissioner in Northern Nigerian Political Service. Very soon after he arrived in Africa, the Great War broke out. He fought the Germans in the Cameroons and was nearly killed. A bullet pierced his helmet, grazed his left occiput, and went right through his ear. It knocked him out, and he thought as he fell that he'd been killed. Well, of course, a bit further over, and I wouldn't be here. He remembered saying to himself, so this is dying. Well, it's not too bad. He became seriously ill by recovering from his wound and was given 3 months' home leave. He immediately proposed again to Gertie, 3 years younger than him, and this time she accepted him. In June 16, they were married, and they spent their wedding night at the rather grand Langham Hotel in London, still there, and right across the road from the BBC. Joyce was desperately thin. He weighed 7 stone and looked ill. Gertie's friends thought she'd married a pretty hopeless prospect. But at least one bit must have been working properly, because by the time he had to go back to Africa, Gertie was pregnant. And their first child was born in April 1917 with Joyce in Africa. The second son was also conceived on another leave, and Peter was born again without Joyce there in December 1918. Joyce was still not well, but planned to soldier on until he would be entitled to a modest pension. During the last part of the African service, he wrote some short stories, which he sent to a literary agent in London, who liked them and in turn sent them to the Saturday Evening Post in the USA. Most of them were accepted, and Joyce was paid handsomely. In fact, he got more for those stories than a whole year's salary in his poorly paid African job. This encouraged him to think he could live by writing, a view reinforced by his father-in-law, Maxwell Ogilvy. "Don't go back to Africa. For one thing, you'll soon be dead if you do. For another, it's not fair on Gertie to leave her alone so much." She was still living with her children in Harrow. The couple had never yet set up home together, and Joyce hardly knew his children. Ogilvy urged Joyce to take up writing seriously, told him he believed in his talent, and said he'd back him financially, particularly with the looming education bills. So Joyce resigned, accepting that he wouldn't get a pension, and in 1920, he and Gertie bought a 99-year lease on 12 Parks Road, Oxford. From then on, Gertie became Trudy. Neither of them liked Gertie. Mum used to say it sounded like a music hall turn, Bertie and Gertie. My first wife, Doris, had similar complaints. "Maids in plays always get called Doris," she said. "You can clear away the tea things now, Doris." So she's always been Dorse. Joyce dismissed those Saturday Evening Post stories as lightweight potboilers. Having more or less wasted his formal education, he set out in the 20s to self-educate. He read massively, biography, history, philosophy, and made careful analyses of the techniques of the great writers of all periods. Trudy's highly successful brothers were forging ahead with distinguished careers. Heneage, later Sir Heneage, became a top-flight orthopaedic surgeon, and Fred, also later to become Sir Frederick, was rising rapidly to the academic hierarchy. In the 30s, he was Vice-Chancellor of Queen's University, Belfast, and after that, the second Director-General of the BBC after Lord Reith. They observed Joyce's non-output and thought he was at best a dilettante and at worst a fraud. They felt sorry for their sister. In fact, as well as studying, Joyce was working on an enormous novel, Cock Jarvis, but he never managed to finish it, one of his great regrets, because he thought there was some of his best stuff in it. He did some other things too. During the general strike of 1926, he volunteered as a docker and helped to unload ships at Hayes Wharf, London Docks. He was paid 12 shillings a day. In 1929, Maxwell Ogilvy died, and the informal financial backing abruptly stopped. His money had been put into a trust to be administered by Heneage and Fred. So instead of getting a proper legacy which she and Joyce could invest, Trudy was forced to be content with the paltry sums her cautious brothers doled out from time to time. On top of this, the stock exchange crash of the late 20s led to the depression of the 30s. The financial position was dire, and Joyce decided to start publishing, though not hopeful of much income from it. His first three novels were all based on his African experiences. Aissa Saved in 1932, An American Visitor in 1933, both more or less sunk without trace from the sales point of view. But his third, The African Witch, in 1936, was picked by the Book Society as their choice for the month. It's still got its red banner on it out there, The African Witch. That put him on the map a bit. So it sold better and put Joyce's name on the literary map, but there was still a big gap between income and necessary expenditure. I was born in 1925, so I was seven when Aissa Saved appeared, and the youngest boy, George, came along in 1927. Sometimes in the 30s, we children got unexpected holidays. Going with both parents to Ireland, where we stayed with relatives in what was by now Northern Ireland. I discovered many years later that Trudy and Joyce were so broke that they let the Oxford house and took advantage of the willing hospitality of our more prosperous cousins in Castle Dawson, a small town halfway between Belfast and Londonderry. The family owned a flourishing linen factory. After 1936, Joyce was an established author, and dust jackets began to say things like Joyce Carey's latest novel. The fourth book was the first non-African one, Castle Corner, which I said above was largely about the family before the disaster. Read Carey for Corner, but it's a proper novel, not merely a historical account. The last book before the war, and his last African story, Mr. Johnson, later considered one of his best works, and produced as a first as a play in New York and London, and later as a film starring Pierce Brosnan and directed by Australian Bruce Beresford. Mr. Johnson also contains a lot of autobiography. The main white character, Radbeck, shares many experiences with Joyce, including building a road, one of the first in those remote parts. Mr. Johnson was the last book he published with Victor Golanx. For one thing, he highly disapproved of the timid folk who rushed off to America to avoid the war. There were lots of those. Mr. Johnson went very well, and the first impression had sold out by November 1939. Because of nervousness about the war, Golanx did not reprint it, which probably lost Joyce a lot of money. A new publisher, Michael Joseph, was just starting up, and being anxious to have some established authors on his list, he more or less headhunted Joyce and offered him much more favourable terms than Golanx had. He stayed with Michael Joseph for the rest of his life, and with Harper in America. It wasn't until after the war that Joseph got around to relaunching Mr. Johnson, so at last the people who'd heard about it and wanted to read it were able to. By rights, Joyce should have been earning money from that book all through the war. By now, there were quite a few foreign language editions as well. My elder brothers Michael and Peter were in the war from the start, Michael in the Royal Navy and Peter in the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry, a mouthful of a regimental name usually abbreviated to something short and rude. Peter was the only one of us wounded. A hand grenade broke his right arm in two places in the Italian fighting. I was 18 in 1943 and also joined the Navy, but George, who was never a well person and later died at only 26, was unfit. In any case, the war would have been over before he was old enough. Joyce was post-air raid warden for our area, and Mum joined the housewife service. She had to call at every house, every pub, anywhere with accommodation in quite a large area of Oxford, get to know everybody, and find out who could put up bombed-out people in the event of raids. Dad also took a high explosive course, qualifying him to defuse unexploded bombs. Typical of your father, said Mum, to go for the most dangerous thing he can think of. During the war, Joyce wrote a whole string of books, including the first trilogy, Herself Surprised in 1941, To Be a Pilgrim in 1942, and The Horse's Mouth in 1944. But even though they sold well, and both critics and fellow writers were saying nice things about him, the money coming in was still not enormous. He was never a runaway bestseller and was regarded by some as difficult. He only began to make real money after my mother died of breast cancer in 1949. So sadly, she wasn't there to enjoy his prosperity with him. By an awful coincidence of events, Trudy died on the very night of my own debut in London, a piano piece of mine played at Wigmore Hall. Mum had asked to be buried in her wedding dress, and this was done. Back in 1944, the final stages of The Horse's Mouth, during the final stages of The Horse's Mouth, Joyce cut out a chapter because he'd introduced a new character and he thought there were more than enough people in the novel already. So he wrote a new chapter using existing characters. Mum, who typed all his books until she became ill in 1948, protested, "Why have you cut out my favourite chapter, Joyce?" she said. Joyce explained why, but she was quite grumpy about typing the new version. Joyce thought about it and promised Judy that he'd publish her chapter, as a short story. No one could know in 1944 that Trudy had only 5 years left to live, and he never managed to get round to publishing it in her lifetime. Years later, not far from Dad's own death, Herbert Davis from the University Printers rang Joyce up and said they had a very ancient flatbed press going almost back to Caxton, and they were keen to try printing something with it. Not too long, Davis said, Have you got something about 10,000 to 15,000 words? Joyce remembered that chapter and dug it out, titled it The Old Strife at Plants, and sent it to Davis, who was delighted. Strife for wife is not really correct rhyming slang, in which one would normally say the word that doesn't rhyme. I'm a scarper, scarper flow, go. But using trouble instead of strife would be misleading. The old trouble at Plants would sound like a problem, not a person. He did illustrations as well, hand in colour by three young friends. Only 100 copies were printed, of which I have copy 4, so it's a very rare item. The day after Mum died, a friend called to see how she was. I'm sorry, said Joyce, she left yesterday. Picking up the pieces of his life, he realised, among many things, that he'd lost his typist for good. He tried, but unsuccessfully, to learn how to type. Another problem was his appalling handwriting. It looked like a series of slightly wobbly lines with a few dots above. Mum, who knew it so well, could read most of it, but even she had to leave gaps for Joyce to fill in later. Knowing that he would have to employ a typing service or a typist who came to a Parks Road, he attempted to reform his writing, making slow and careful characters, but I'm afraid it lapsed back into the old scrawl, except for letters, which he took care to make legible. Edith Millen, his highly competent assistant for the rest of his life, and a very nice woman, also had to leave gaps for Joyce to fill in. Joyce was by now celebrated. There were cartoons and photos of him. Eric Kennington did his portrait. He went regularly to New York, which he loved. He was given the freedom of New Orleans and feted everywhere. His publisher had a permanent room at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, and Joyce was free to use it any time. Americans, in fact, bought and read more of his books than Britons. In 1955, he was booked to give some lectures in Greece and Cyprus, and duly boarded a Viscount prop jet at Heathrow to fly to Athens. The weather was foggy, but not considered foggy enough to ground aircraft. Somehow, Joyce's pilot was assigned the wrong runway. As the plane was reaching takeoff speed, a steel fence right across the runway suddenly appeared in the gloom. The runway was under repair and shouldn't have been assigned to anyone. The undercarriage was torn off, and the plane crashed down on its belly, skidding down the runway, rotating and gradually stopping. Fortunately, it did not catch fire. And there were only a few minor injuries. Everybody would have been strapped in at that stage, you see. Joyce was physically quite okay, but obviously very shaken up. A doctor examined all the passengers, and Joyce, by now 66, was strongly advised to book into a hotel and rest for a few days. But if he had signed up to do a job, he was meticulous in carrying it out. No, he said, I've lost enough time already. I'll take the next flight to Athens. Well, the trip went to plan after that, but when he came back, worrying things began to happen. He never drank much, but he would suddenly stagger about, even fall down, like a drunk. He'd get up and say, how odd. Why did that happen? He fell off his bicycle, so he had to stop him cycling. He never ran a car after the war. While he was still reasonably mobile, we fixed handholds along any route in the house he was likely to take, so there was something to grab if he thought he was falling. He soon gave up even attempting stairs. It may have had nothing to do with it, but I've always believed that the shaking up he received that day at London Airport somehow triggered what was soon diagnosed as disseminated neuritis. Today it would be called motor neurone disease. For the next 2 years, he steadily lost one motor function after another. He said he could predict the next loss by a sort of pulsing in the muscle. His head remained clear till the end, but communication was the problem. After he lost the use of his legs, he worked in a wheelchair, but writing became increasingly difficult, and I bought the best but lightest weight dictating machine I could find. For a time, Edith Millen typed from a mini-tape, but eventually his voice almost disappeared, and his whisper could not adequately record on the machine. Very soon after that radio interview we heard at the beginning of this session, recorded about 6 months before he died, his voice began to go completely. It was all terribly fast. While he could still grip with his fingers, he did the self-portrait dithograph and the illustrations for the planned deluxe edition of The Horse's Mouth. It's all out there. He had never done a lithograph before, and he couldn't manage a heavy stone, so he used a zinc plate. Working in a new medium is fun, he said. He didn't live to see the finished product, alas. He actually did two self-portraits, but didn't like the first one. You can see them side by side in the exhibition. My own transport at that time was a 1938 London taxi, bought from the London General Cab Co. for £70. A good vehicle if you have small children, because in the spacious passenger compartment, Dorse could do everything, feed babies, change nappies, etc. The elder boy, John, used to slide back the glass partition and say pompously, "Stop here, driver, will you? And what do I owe you?" There was no way Joyce could be got into an ordinary car, but with his big doors, the taxi could take him. One day he asked me to drive him to the country around Oxford for a last look at the old picnic haunts and the Cotswold views that he and Mum used to enjoy together. Dad insisted on going to hear my first feature film score for Ealing's The Lady Killers when the movie came to Oxford. It was quite a business. We placed a wheelchair ready at the cinema. I drove in there in the taxi and he was carefully decanted from the taxi and wheeled in, and the reverse process afterwards. After his voice went, he was back to writing. It was back to writing of a kind. Joyce's next-door neighbour was Judge Hurst, Sir Donald Hurst, who worried a lot about his friend's decline. As well as being a judge, Hurst was a keen carpenter, and he made Joyce a writing machine. A sloping board on a raised stand, so that it could be used in or out of bed, was fitted with a big roll of paper, probably 30 feet long. This was at the bottom of the board. At the top was a mechanism with two rollers, a bit like a mangle, for pulling the paper up and spilling it out, where there was an edge for tearing it off squarely. On the right of the pull-up gear was a metal plate about 4 inches square, which actuated a switch to start the adapted toy electric crane motor, which pulled up the paper. It stopped automatically when you took your hand off the plate. Dad's hand and arm were so weak by now that he couldn't write in the ordinary way. We taped a ballpoint to his fingers and suspended his arm by a cord from the ceiling, the right height for the ballpoint to touch the paper on the machine. You don't need much strength to swing a suspended arm, and his writing was pretty wild, but just legible. If he wanted a fresh page, he swung his hand against the switch, and the paper moved up. For the last few weeks of his life, this was how he kept working, and the writing machine is in the main Joyce Carey collection in the Bodleian Library. There's a letter to me done on the machine out there. His final novel in progress, The Captive and the Free, was in a large box under the bed, in case he wanted to work on it, but he knew he could never get back to the massive task of finishing it. His last activity was mainly letters, and from their lively and acute contents, you would never guess that they were written by a dying man. Finally, the writing machine had to be abandoned, and Edith Millin bent down and did her best with his faint whisper. At all times, his eyes were alert, and he could hear exactly what was going on around him. As well as Edith, a cook housekeeper had been there for some time, a competent woman named Nora Lightburn, who shopped, cooked and meals and generally kept the house going. She was also a trained masseuse. Joyce was 68 when he died in March 57. Back in 1949, knowing that Trudy could not last much longer, he had bought a double plot at Wolvercote Cemetery, just north of Oxford, where Mum lies, and in 1957 he joined her. On my last visit to Oxford, I went to see if the grave was in good order. It was fine. That large municipal cemetery is very well run, and they weed and tidy the graves and mow the grass around them. Thank you.